This is Jim Eakster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. And we start our day with a special guest, Lawrence O'Donnell. Many of us have watched him for years as the host of The Last Word on MSNBC, and that popular program continues at 9 o'clock Central Time. If you'd like to join the conversation today, 877-217-5757. You can email us talk@talklouisiana.org. Lawrence O'Donnell's latest work is Playing with Fire, the 1968 election and the transformation of American politics. It's been 49 years since Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey and George Wallace faced each other in November of 1968, and it's an amazing portrait of the election and what led up to it. Lawrence O'Donnell, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
You were in high school at the time, but you say it made a profound impression on you, this election.
I think it did for everyone who was just old enough, anyone in high school who happened to be watching any of the political coverage on TV with our parents. And this was a stunning year when I look back at it to realize all of the enormous dramatic events that happened in this one presidential election year. It is by far, incomparably, the most dramatic and chaotic and violent presidential campaign year in history. It began with this insurgency on the left side of the Democratic Party, Gene McCarthy deciding to take on his own president, his own Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson, went up to New Hampshire, challenged him, came in second, but such a strong second that LBJ and the Democratic establishment was shocked. Bobby Kennedy then jumped into the race, so there were two challengers to Johnson, and Johnson then quit. He simply gave up and did not run for re-election. That was inconceivable. That would have been the most dramatic event in any other presidential election year, but that was followed by Martin Luther King Jr. being assassinated. Martin Luther King Jr. had joined the anti-war movement. He had married the causes of civil rights and the peace movement, saying that young black men should not be going to Vietnam to fight in that war when they didn't have the rights they deserved at home. He connected. Martin Luther King was the one who really connected all the dots that year. He was assassinated in the first week of April. Bobby Kennedy, as a presidential candidate in Indianapolis that night, had to announce the assassination of Martin Luther King to a black crowd of supporters who had gathered for him for a rally. And their cheers for Bobby Kennedy immediately turned to tears when he announced this news to them. Rioting broke out all over the United States that night, but it did not happen in Indianapolis, where Bobby Kennedy had delivered that news. 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. A few months after that, you go into a Democratic convention that is filled with rioting in the streets of Chicago every day of the convention. Riots actually break out, mini riots break out inside the convention hall. And it all ends in a case of collusion, our first case of collusion and our only proven case of collusion. Republican candidate Richard Nixon colluded with the South Vietnamese government to prolong the war and make sure the war was going badly for the United States on Election Day, because Nixon believed if the war is going badly, Vietnam War, then Nixon will win. LBJ, having dropped out of the race, really seriously devoted himself to trying to bring an end to the war in Vietnam and was maneuvering toward peace talks. And he got South Vietnam to agree to come to Paris for peace talks. The South Vietnamese promised that their delegation would be in Paris 2 days later. Richard Nixon intervened with them secretly. We now have all of the CIA's notes on this, all of the FBI wiretaps on this, and that where they picked up what Nixon was doing. And Nixon got the South Vietnamese government to change its mind and to say to the President of the United States, we're not going to go to Paris. We're not going to participate in any peace talks. And so on Election Day, the war looked as bad as Nixon wanted it to look, thanks to his collusion with South Vietnam. And Nixon won by less than 1% of the vote.
The book is Playing with Fire, the 1968 election and the transformation of American politics, from Lawrence O'Donnell, who was 16 when the year of 1968 began, and it is a year like no other in American history. Richard Nixon, left for dead after losing the 1962 California governor's election, ends up being elected president. He defeated a wounded Hubert Humphrey with George Wallace carrying some states, including Louisiana. But if Bobby Kennedy had not been shot and killed, shot on June 5th at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, would he have won?
I believe that he would have, and Richard Nixon believed that he would have. Richard Nixon lived in fear of a Bobby Kennedy candidacy. Lyndon Johnson lived in fear of a Bobby Kennedy candidacy. Every other potential candidate for president on the Republican side was afraid that Bobby Kennedy would run, and their plans depended on whether Bobby Kennedy would run. And so at first it appeared that he wasn't going to run, and so Johnson and Nixon felt pretty good about that. But when Nixon saw Bobby Kennedy make his candidacy announcement, Nixon sat there staring at the TV even after Kennedy finished, and he for a while couldn't move. And said, nothing good is going to come of this. He felt terribly afraid of the Kennedy candidacy because Jack Kennedy had beaten Richard Nixon once before. Nixon had run against Kennedy before. He knew how difficult it was. And Richard Nixon, when he lost in 1960, was the first vice president in history to lose a presidential election. Every sitting vice president prior to Richard Nixon won when they ran for president. Nixon lost to Jack Kennedy by less than 1% of the vote, and he believed Bobby Kennedy had even more momentum in 1968 than Jack Kennedy would have had in 1960.
How much of a factor was George Wallace on this race?
He was an enormous factor in the race, and he pulled Nixon farther and farther to the right because they were competing for the same voters. And George Wallace, Alabama segregationist governor, decided to just go out of the Democratic Party and run as an independent in 1968. So this was a serious problem for Nixon as the fall campaign really got underway, because that's when George Wallace started to surge in the polls, and he was taking voters away from Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon did everything he possibly could to mimic George Wallace because he needed that same voter. Before he started running for president, George Wallace used to say to reporters, I don't talk about segregation anymore, I talk about law and order. And Nixon heard that phrase, and Nixon made that phrase his own, law and order. And as we know, every Republican presidential candidate since then has claimed the law and order label. That was coined for them by George Wallace. And interestingly, the thing that collapsed the Wallace candidacy, the thing that made it go backwards, was the day he introduced his vice presidential candidate, who was a former Air Force general, Curtis LeMay, who was in charge of our bombing missions. And Curtis LeMay believed in bombing. He also believed in the use of nuclear weapons, and actually said that Trumpian thing of, you know, if we have them, we might as well use them. And he said that the day he was introduced as a candidate. And Curtis LeMay started to get into a discussion with the press about, you know, does it really matter if you're killed by a dagger in the jungles of Vietnam or killed by a nuclear bomb? And he implied that he personally would prefer maybe to be killed by a nuclear bomb. The country was terrified by that. Even Wallace voters, when they heard that, they turned away. And Wallace's support collapsed. You cut to 2016, Donald Trump says things that sound like Curtis LeMay, and he didn't lose a single supporter over that.
Lawrence, how much was at play as far as the emotions of the election of 2016 compared to 1968?
It was a deeply emotional time for everyone, and in every direction. Every 18-year-old man had to have a draft card in his pocket, and it was a federal crime not to have it. And that draft card was your ticket to Vietnam. The draft was the fastest way to be shipped out to Vietnam. And so that was a threat that existed everywhere in the country, in every family, almost every family. And if it wasn't in your family, it was your grandson, your nephew, it was your cousin, your boyfriend. You know, even families of all girls, you know, their boyfriends had these draft cards. Their boyfriends could be shipped out. And by 1968, it appeared to be a hopeless war. It didn't appear hopeless in 64. It seemed like something that the United States would be able to handle. By 1968, it was out of control. 16,000 combat casualties for the United States in Vietnam in 1968. That was the year that my cousin Johnny was killed in Vietnam. Having just graduated from West Point, 90 days later, he was killed in Vietnam. And that was just one of the over 16,000 military funerals that year. In all of our action, all of our military action in Iraq and Afghanistan combined for the last 16 years, we're at somewhere around 6,400 deaths, something like that.
The book is
just to give you an order of magnitude that we're talking about.
Playing with Fire from Lawrence O'Donnell, an important book that has relevance to today. We thank you for joining us, Lawrence. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim, very much.
And we're back with Walter Isaacson right here on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. We're joined now by Walter Isaacson, another stellar journalistic icon, University of History professor at Tulane, former chairman of CNN and former editor of Time magazine, a New Orleanian who has written prolifically and with great success about other men in history, including Albert Einstein and Steve Jobs, Henry Kissinger, and his latest work is Leonardo da Vinci, and it is a spellbinding book. Good morning, Walter Isaacson.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's nice to talk with you. And the guest on before, Lawrence O'Donnell, is a man you rubbed shoulders with for a few years.
Right. I met him when I went up to college. We were both right in that post-Vietnam generation. You know, we got up in the early 70s.
This was at Harvard, and you are a graduate of Isadore Newman School, and very proudly so, a school that's produced some great people, both from the journalistic realm and, of course, athletically. But Walter Isaacson, you're going back a few centuries with Leonardo da Vinci. It's a magnificent book about one of the most important persons in the history of the world. But it is amazing how much information you had at your disposal to do this enormous and significant profile of da Vinci.
Yes, you know, what's wonderful about paper is that it's a great technology for storing information. Unlike all of our tweets and Facebook posts and things like that, after 500 years, you can go back and just go page after page of more than 7,000 pages of Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks. And what that shows you is how he connected engineering and technology to his art. And, you know, we think of him as an artist who paints the Mona Lisa, The Last Supper. Well, yes, but he was also a theater producer, an anatomist, somebody who loved geology. And when you look at his notebooks, you realize, oh, I get it. The creativity comes from being interested in everything. It's sort of like in Louisiana. I mean, we're very much that way. New Orleans, west of Louisiana. You know, music and food and engineering and energy and petroleum, you know, and the Saints. We love it all. And I think if your mind crosses many disciplines, you see patterns and you get to be more creative and you get to be like a Louisiana person. And Leonardo was that way.
You, I think, have a fascination with genius. I think, obviously, Steve Jobs was a genius in his way, and Albert Einstein certainly was. And then Leonardo da Vinci, he's been called the most significant creative genius in our time or any time before us. How creative was this man?
Well, he was very human. Let's get that established. There are paintings he didn't finish. There's engineering designs he never got accomplished. He makes mistakes. And so that's what made me like him more. I remember when I was writing about Einstein, Einstein was such a superhuman genius, you could hardly relate to him. But this guy, you can get. And it's mainly his curiosity and his observation that teach him things. He didn't go to college. He was illegitimate born. And so he has to teach himself. And that's part of his creative curiosity.
You note that he was a left-hander, and in some quarters, some might think this was would be relevant or would not be relevant, but it is. Why?
Well, he wrote in mirror script, meaning he wrote from right to left so he wouldn't smudge the ink, and that made him, sort of look, his notebook seemed special. But also, all things about him were he was slightly a misfit. He was a vegetarian for a while. He was illegitimate. He was gay. He was left-handed. So he had all these things that said, I'm a little bit of an outsider. But the cool thing about Florence in the late 1400s under the Medici family that ran Florence is, they were kind of easygoing, tolerant. So this kind of unusual kid appears from the village of Vinci, and everybody loves him. And, he gets all sorts of work, both as an engineer and as an artist. So it's a little bit of an argument for, hey, live and let live.
Well, you note that he was gay, and we're talking about the 1500s, and certainly he was a man of his time, but it's amazing you were able to unearth his companions. How did this affect his work, if at all?
Not much. It wasn't that big of a deal. As I said, there was an easygoing live and let live feel in Florence up until the end of the century, the end of the 1400s, when there's sort of a backlash with the Brown Fire of the Vanities and, a backlash against heretics, as they were called. But when Leonardo lived there, there were people, he was religious, but he was also, as I say, a bit of a misfit, and he's pretty well tolerated. He's not shy about it at all, unlike Michelangelo, who's living there at the same time and has sort of the agony of who he is and how he fits in. But I do think it made Leonardo always feel like a tiny bit of an outsider, and that helps. I mean, if you're going to be a great artist, if you're going to think different the way Steve Jobs did, it helps to be a bit of an outsider and to sort of challenge the conventional wisdom. I think Leonardo got the balance about right. He was friendly. He was collegial. He, was well-liked on all of Florence, but he also challenged conventional wisdom sometimes.
You note the simple statement from Leonardo that the eyes are the window of the soul affected his work in everything he did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was extraordinarily observant. And he even noticed that your eyes, because he dissected the human eye to figure out how it worked, sees detail at the very center and colors and shadows on the edges of the retina. So when he paints the Mona Lisa, he paints the tiny black and white details of her smile going straight, but the shadows and colors turning up. So as your eye wanders, the smile flickers on and off. But in a more philosophical sense, he felt that if you just kept your eyes open and observed things, and he would make a list in his notebooks of the things he wanted to observe each week, like why does water when it falls into a pond create swirls? Why is the sky blue? What mm-hmm. does the tongue of a woodpecker look like? How would you measure the sun? All these things, some of which are just pretty mundane, like why is the sky blue? You and I see a blue sky almost every day. But Leonardo had a desire to observe it carefully. And I think we can learn from Leonardo, which is, as we're walking down the street, put away the iPhone for just a moment and observe how a bird wing flops up and down or how a cloud forms, the type of things that he was always observing.
The Mona Lisa is something he is regarded for above all others. And, of course, his life was more than the Mona Lisa, but it's probably worth $1 billion or more, and it has certainly had staying power. What is it that is so captivating about that painting?
It is probably the painting that most affects how we connect with a subject emotionally. As I said, her smile is elusive, mysterious. Her eyes follow us around. She's connected to the earth by that river that flows down from the ancient mountains and sort of connects to her soul. You see it in the painting. And so, like Vitruvian Man, the guy standing in the circle and square that he drew, it's a way of saying, how do we fit in to God's creation, and what are the emotions that are deep into our soul? And you don't get other paintings that do that as profoundly as the Mona Lisa.
We're visiting with Walter Isaacson. His latest work is Leonardo da Vinci. The author of Steve Jobs and Einstein has taken on this man who lived in the 1500s. Da Vinci's creativity, like that of other great innovators, came from standing at the intersection of humanities and technology, peeling the flesh off the faces of cadavers, drawing the muscles that move the lips, and painted history's most memorable smile on the Mona Lisa. Before we go to the break, why did you choose Da Vinci to be your latest subject?
I had done a lot of very smart people, Ben Franklin, Albert Einstein, and then Steve Jobs. And it began to occur to me that there was a pattern, which is, it's not that they were smart. You and I know a lot of smart people, and they don't usually amount to much. What makes them important is creativity, imagination, being able, as Steve Jobs said, to think different. You just mentioned that if you stand at the intersection of the humanities and the science, if you're both creative and love, you know, music and the arts, but you also love the beauty of science and engineering. And
we do have to take a break, but we'll be back and hear more from the remarkable Walter Isaacson on WRKF. Now the news from Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing. Our guest is Walter Isaacson for another segment, the New Orleanian, who is one of the men synonymous with historical figures from Ben Franklin to Steve Jobs to Albert Einstein. His latest target is Leonardo da Vinci, already a best-selling book, and it is an amazing compilation of the life of Leonardo da Vinci, who lived from 1452 to 1519. He was here before Shakespeare was on our earth, but I'm sure Shakespeare, like everybody else, was affected by the work of Da Vinci. And before we went to the break, Walter, you were noting that you chose him for your latest work after giving it some thought, but it sounds like it wasn't a hard choice.
No, having done Ben Franklin, Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, I wanted somebody like them who combined all there was to love, you know, arts, sciences, engineering, humanities, and Leonardo's the ultimate of that. You know, he's the person who wanted to know everything you could possibly know about every subject that was knowable about creation, including how do we fit into it.
You note that he had an impact on the study of water and flight. He was a man certainly ahead of his time.
Yeah, I mean, he loved growing up in the little village of Vinci near Florence, and like a lot of us, you know, putting pebbles into a stream, putting rocks, seeing how the water rippled around rocks and seeing how it formed swirls and how you would divert and build little dams to divert a river. You see that in everything he does. The very first painting he works on is the baptism of Christ when he's just a young kid in Florence working in a studio there. And he does the water rippling past the ankles of Jesus in a beautifully scientific way. But then he also, years later, works with Machiavelli, Niccolo Machiavelli, the famous writer who did The Prince, on a way to divert the Arno River so that Florence can have a direct access to the sea. And then he does heart dissections, and he looks at the flow of blood through the heart and figures out how the swirls work and how that causes the heart valve to close. So throughout his life, he loved, you know, everything, but including fluid and flows of water and blood and how swirls are formed.
And he was a remarkable map maker.
Yeah, he was very good at the visual display of information. When he's doing his dissections, he does wonderful cross-section pictures. When he's working for Caesar Borgia, the great warlord of the time, they're in a tiny town of Imola with Machiavelli, and Leonardo does aerial maps, which, you know, they didn't have planes back then. They didn't have drones. So he would pace off the streets and just do a map that was like seen from a bird, and it gave Caesar Borgia a great advantage because he knew the terrain better than his enemy. Mm-hmm. So all of these things come from Leonardo, as you said, you know, having that eye, that ability to observe things and then imagine.
Has there been a Renaissance man of his caliber? I know sometimes we engage in hyperbole or exaggeration, but in this case, it would seem that he was the quintessential Renaissance man.
I think so. There have been a lot of people like him who, you know, tried to learn everything. Ben Franklin, one of my early characters, did. But the reason I chose Leonardo da Vinci, after all these years of writing about creative people and how do you achieve creativity, how do you achieve innovation, was I thought he was the greatest in history at combining all of these disciplines and being imaginative.
I noted, Walter, that da Vinci was born in 1452, and this coincided with Gutenberg opening his publishing house. This was a significant time.
Absolutely. It was a wonderful time, and it's when Christopher Columbus was born. But by opening his print shop, Gutenberg, it spread all over Europe, especially Italy, the publishing industry. So a young kid like Leonardo da Vinci, who didn't go to college, he found 400 books that he got before he was 30 years old, and he taught himself things from mathematics to anatomy to painting. And so it's like the birth of the Internet, but even more so, it meant that if you wanted to learn something, you were able to do so.
Would he have been a tweeter?
No, he didn't. You know, I think he didn't publish that much. He didn't like to show off his own writings, so he kind of kept them in his notebooks. So I think too much tweeting and too much social media would not have appealed to him.
Mm-hmm. Now, if a historian comes in the next 100 years or so, or maybe beyond that, and writes a book about where we are right now with certainly an interesting person as the leader of the free world, what do you think they will think about us right now?
Well, I think they will say that it was a time of creativity like the late 1400s in Florence, because you have the Internet, the personal computer, the microchip, all connecting to the creative arts, whether it's, you know, music or art or whatever. And so I think the digital revolution is what will be remembered for more than who's president and who was Secretary of State. Because I think the way, say, even just the iPhone, which Steve Jobs invented, has changed our lives, that'll be the thing 100 years from now. People will look back at our science and our technology. But I do hope also, and Louisiana is good at this, but we, you know, I may say we waver back and forth, that ability to live and let live that you found in Florence, you also found it in the Bay Area of California 500 years later, in the 1960s when they were inventing the computer and the Internet. I think, you know, sort of just getting along with everybody, that type of live and let live mentality was so important for Leonardo. And sometimes we backslide from that, less so in Louisiana than in other places, which is why I love my state so much.
You say Leonardo knew how to marry observation and imagination. That may be his principal gift.
Yes. I mean, he loved theater design, for example. So he would look at birds and have really beautiful bird wings, but he would turn them into angels as well. And he blurred the line, like he made that sort of helicopter-like device that's a somewhat famous drawing. Well, he actually made that for the theater. It was a invention of the imagination, but then he said, well, let's try it out. Let's see if I can build flying machines. So I think that ability to both observe very well and be very realistic, but also be imaginative and creative and think different, and to blur the line between imagination and reality helps make creativity happen.
Walter, you note that more than 7,200 pages of notes and scribbles are available from Da Vinci, an amazing find. Did you know this when you went into this project?
No, not really. I had known Bill Gates from some of the other books I had done and from being at Time Magazine, and then he bought one of Leonardo's notebooks 10 or 12 years ago, and it was on geology and science, and so he showed it off. And then I thought, well, where are these other notebooks? And fortunately, they're in places like Florence and Venice and Milan and Paris and London. So it was fun to go see them. And that's when I came to the realization that nobody really focused on those notebooks that he left. And with more than 7,000 pages, you can get a good sense, because, you know, he would cram a whole lot on one page, and you'd see his mind dancing across nature, from painting the expressions of somebody who's going to be in the Last Supper, and then dissecting the way the muscles touch the lips, all on the same page. That's a pretty cool way to look at how somebody's mind is working.
And you say the best way to approach Leonardo's life is the way he approached the world.
Yes, I think you should approach it by being open to mystery. I mean, you know, there's a lot of mysteries about Leonardo's life. There's a lot of mysteries about everybody's life. And instead of worrying about them, he was open to mystery. And that may be the ultimate lesson of Leonardo, is learn as much as you can, be as realistic as you can, but then be open to the mystery of creation.
I love your affinity for your home state and your home city, and you grew up in New Orleans, born there in 1952. How much did that experience shape the work you're doing now?
Being raised in southern Louisiana and loving nature, you know, hunting, duck hunting, whatever it would be, but also being in a city that celebrated creativity and had a whole lot of different types of people. I remember when I was growing up, the Vietnamese, you know, were coming in after the fall of Vietnam. And there was such diversity. I realized, well, that's how jazz got created, all these people flowing in to New Orleans. And so I began to love the mix of cultures that brings you jambalaya and gumbo and jazz, but also just a wonderful lifestyle. And so it made me open to trying to be interested in everything. My dad was an engineer. He worked on the design of the Superdome, but he also loved music and he loved art. And so I think growing up in New Orleans made me one of those people who didn't get siloed. I didn't try to just specialize in being, you know, an engineer or being an artist. I began to feel that making the connections and loving that diversity you find in Louisiana with the culture and the music makes you open to more mystery, more experience.
We have about a minute to go with Walter Isaacson. Phil in Jefferson Terrace has been waiting patiently. And Phil, we're short, Phil, but please be brief. You're on with Walter Isaacson.
Okay, good morning, gentlemen. Did you talk about the ecstasy of creativity, that when those connections are made, that there is a definite feeling, a way to describe it, as the act of creation is also something that happens, emotions and feelings.
All right, your thoughts. Thank you, Phil.
Yeah, I do think that the act of creativity comes from both an emotional understanding as well as a realistic understanding of science and math and engineering and music and art. And Leonardo was able to add that emotional component. So when you look at the Mona Lisa, I'll end with this, and you stare at a face and you shift your head and you look again, you realize the depths of emotion that are part of what creativity is all about.
Thank you, Walter Isaacson. Another fabulous work from this fine gentleman from New Orleans, Leonardo da Vinci. It has been an honor and pleasure.
Great talking to you.
And we're back after this pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Sally Baltazar producing. Your number is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633, and you can always send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Wallace Watkins has done some fine reporting on what's going on regarding a lawsuit that relates to the flooding in Tangipahoa Parish from last year's historic flood. And with us to talk about this is a gentleman who's involved as a lawyer and a real character, Bayard Edwards. Last week, the Louisiana Supreme Court dealt a blow to a group of Tangipahoa Parish residents suing the state over the flooding of 2016 that they blame on a section of Interstate 12 that was built decades ago. Good morning to you, Bayard Edwards.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. How disappointed were you in the high court's ruling?
I'll tell you what. I was I don't know, amazed or shocked, because this exact same issue on the exact same statute, revised statute 9:5624, was litigated in the 1983 flood case, District Court, Court of Appeals, Supreme Court. And in every instance, it was unanimously affirmed and ruled on in favor of the plaintiffs. And now the trial court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, but the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court ruled the opposite direction. They reversed themselves and gave no reason, no reason from either court. So I was, Eric and I were both amazed, to put it frankly.
The High Court recently let stand a lower court ruling that blocked the lawsuit from going forward, and the problem is that the lawsuit was filed too long after the highway allegedly first flooded Tangipahoa residents back in 1983. That's according to the First Circuit Court of Appeal. I gather you don't agree with that ruling.
Well, actually, the statute says, says 2 years after the public work is accepted by the state. So that would have been 1979. So I don't think the flood of 1983 would have been applicable because the highway was accepted in 1979. So how could the people have known that they were going to be flooded in 1983? And how could, as a lawyer, how could I have presented to the court the damages, the houses, the number of people that were flooded in 1983? Well, that's ridiculous. Ridiculous. It's stupid. I mean, how in the world could the courts have expected the people to have recommended to have known what the flood was? And in fact, the courts had always said for a public work to cause a damage which would have been prescribed, it had to been, and this is it, the intentional and necessary consequence of that public work. In other words, if the state built a dam, they knew that the necessary consequence of that dam was to flood some land. You build a dam, you flood it. The people who got flooded had 2 years after that to make a complaint. No one believes that the intended consequence of building a highway is to flood somebody. Well, but that is what this time the Court of Appeal and Supreme Court ruled. Now, in 1983, they ruled opposite. They said it was not the intended consequence of this damn highway to flood everybody. And that is the necessary consequence. That's what the courts had ruled. Why they intended to reverse it, I have no idea, but they did.
All right. Well, a story recapping this in The Advocate of last week notes that shortly after the flood of 83, residents of Robert filed a class action suit against the Department of Transportation, winning a $91.8 million judgment in 2006. None of that judgment, which is now worth more than $300 million with legal interest, has been paid out to the 13 successful plaintiffs. Your thoughts about this?
No, it was about almost 2,000 successful plaintiffs.
Okay, so not
1983 flood.
Right. So what do you make of this, the fact that in this case the court awarded these people the money, and yet the money has not been sent to them?
Well, the law says, the Constitution of the state of Louisiana says the state shall pay judgment. Shall has a legal meaning. It's a mandatory word. May is a discretionary word. So the Constitution says the state shall pay judgments. Then it says the legislature shall appropriate. Again, a mandatory word. However, if you go down further into the law, it says the legislature must appropriate the money. You cannot make the legislature appropriate the money. Now, twice in the recent years, I had the legislature willing to appropriate the money, and Mike Foster and Bobby Jindal forced the legislature not to appropriate the money when the legislature was willing to appropriate the money and pay the judgment. So all I can say is the reason these people from the 1983 flood never got paid is due to Mike Foster and Bobby Jindal, who I don't have any use for. But we will deal with that down the road. Now, if you want to go further into these floods of 2016, that litigation is not over with either. Just because the Supreme Court made one ruling does not mean that litigation is over with either.
Well, let's talk about that, Byard Edwards. The state Supreme Court voted 6-0 to let the First Circuit's ruling stand. So where does that leave you? What options do you have?
Okay, that particular lawsuit was the cause of action for that lawsuit was based on the Louisiana Civil Code Articles 654, et cetera, which had to do with blocking a drain. If you block a natural drain, the servitude of drain, and you flood somebody's land, then you have to pay. The Supreme Court ruled, as we just discussed, that that cause of action had prescribed, and I don't know how they figured that out. However, there are other laws which are applicable to these floods, which the Supreme Court has ruled on previously, and a claim has been filed on those claims. There is also a claim pending in a federal court against the U.S. Geological Survey, and it's pending in what's called the Court of Federal Claims in Washington, D.C., a very small court. It's only 12 justices in it. And all the filings have been completed, and we're simply waiting on that court to rule. Okay, so if that court rules, it's a property damage only, but it will cover all the property damage of all the present plaintiffs in the Robert Flood area. There is also pending a claim in the federal court in Baton Rouge. And you got to understand, federal courts do not always do what state courts do. So we have, if the Louisiana Supreme Court wants to reverse a long line of jurisprudence, it does not mean that the federal court is going isn't going to necessarily follow what the Louisiana Supreme Court did.
All right, Byard Peck Edwards, the man we're talking with, and we are short on time. You are the cousin of the governor. Does that help or hurt? Does it matter in this case?
I'm sorry, say that. Repeat
that,
please.
The cousin of our governor. So does that help you?
Let's just leave that out. Leave John Bell out of this. He goes down to Puerto Rico. You know, he got. Oh, we're worried about these people got flooded. He's worried about the people got flooded in Puerto Rico. That's how they were determined.
All right. Well, you are certainly concerned about this 86-mile highway that connects Baton Rouge to Slidell. My impression, Byard, is that you think that it's fraught with danger to this day.
When I first started in the 1983 flood case, I went to LSU and I met with the number one civil engineering professor, who was a PhD civil engineer, and he said, "Mr. Edwards, before we start down this road, I want you to meet with my retired professor." And we went out to his home, and he said, "Mr. Edwards, very few people realize when they build I-12 and I-10 across the state of Louisiana, they dammed up the whole state because no one did any backwater study."
I'm sorry, Byard. We have just gotten started, so we look forward to another conversation with you. Certainly an important event that is taking place and continues to have legal implications. And we'll keep talking about it. But thank you for listening today, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.